You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 63. The Mead of Poetry. When the Aesir and the Vanir had made a truce and settled terms for a lasting peace, every single god and goddess spat into a great jar. This put the seal on their friendship, and because the Aesir were anxious that no one should forget it, even for one moment, they carried off the jar, and out of the spittle they fashioned a man. His name was Kvasir. He was so steeped in all matters and mysteries of the Nine Worlds since fire and ice first met in Ginnungagap that no god nor man, nor giant nor dwarf, ever regretted putting him to a question or asking his opinion. And wherever Kvasir went, news of his coming went before him. When he reached some remote farm or hamlet, sewing and salting and scything and swordplay were laid aside. Even children stopped chattering and listened to his words. What was his secret? It was as much in his manner as in his mind of understanding. Questions of fact he answered with simple facts. But to ask Kvasir for his opinion, what shall I say? What do you think? What shall I do? Did not always mean getting a direct answer. Sitting back in his ill-fitting clothes, as often as not with his eyes closed, he would listen to recitals of problems and sorrows with a kind, grave, blank face. He took in and set everything in a wider frame. He never intruded or insisted, rather he suggested. Often enough he answered a question with another question. He made gods and men, giants and dwarfs, feel that they had helped to answer their own questions. The stories of Kvasir's wisdom soon reached the ears of the most unpleasant pair of brothers, the dwarves Fialar and Galar. Their interest soon turned to envy, and their envy to energy, for they could not admire anything without wanting it for themselves. They asked Kvasir to feast with them, in a large gathering of dwarves in their caves beneath the earth, and it was as his custom Kvasir accepted. The table was a long slab of uneven rock. The floor was grit, and the wall hangings were dripping stalactites. The talk was mainly of profit and loss and petty revenge. The food, however, and the tableware, all made of hammered gold, were rather more pleasing. After the feast, Fialar and Galar asked Kvasir for a word in private. Kvasir followed them into a gloomy chamber, and that was a mistake. The two dwarves had knives hidden in their sleeves, and at once they buried them in the wise man's chest. His blood spurted out of his body, and Fialar and Galar caught it all in two large jars, Son and Bone, and a cauldron named Odrarir. Kvasir's heart stopped pumping, and his drained white body lay still on the ground. When, after a while, the Aesir sent a messenger to ask after Kvasir, the two dwarves sent back word that he had unfortunately choked on his own learning, because there was no one in the Nine Worlds well informed enough to compare and compete with him. But Fialar and Galar were delighted with what they had done. They poured honey into the jars and cauldron filled with Kvasir's blood, and with ladles stirred the mixture. The blood and honey formed a sublime mead. Whoever drank it became a poet or a wise man. The dwarves kept this mead to themselves. No one else tasted it. No one even heard about it. One day the dwarf brothers entertained two gruesome guests, the giant Gilling and his wife. It was not long before they began to quarrel, and Fialar and Galar became more and more spiteful and full of hate. They suggested that Gilling might enjoy the sea breeze, and each taking an oar, rowed far out into the ocean surrounding Midgard. Then the dwarves rammed their boat into a slimy, half-submerged rock. Gilling was alarmed and gripped one gunwale. His alarm was well-founded. The boat floundered and capsized. Gilling was unable to swim, and that was the end of Gilling. The two dwarves cheerfully righted their craft and rowed home singing. Fjallar and Gaur described what had happened to Gilling's wife.
"An accident," said Fjallar.
"If only he'd been able to swim," Gaur said sadly.
Gilling's wife wept and wept, sitting in their cave. The two dwarves did not like the feel of the tepid water washing around their ankles.
"I've an idea," whispered Fjallar to his brother. "Find a millstone and go and wait above the entrance to the cave."
Gaur got up and went outside, and Fjallar asked the giantess,
"Would it help if you looked out at sea? I could show you the place where he drowned."
Gilling's wife stood up sobbing, and Fjallar stepped aside for her as it befits a host. And when the giantess stepped out into the daylight, Gaur dropped the millstone onto her head.
"I was sick of her wailing," said Fjallar.
When Gilling and his wife did not return to Jotunheim, their son Suttung set out in search of them. He looked at the dwarves' dismal faces and listened to their lengthy tales, and then he seized both of them by the scruff of their necks. Holding one in each hand, a pair of danglers, he angrily waded a mile out to sea until it was too deep even for him. Then Suttung dumped Fjallar and Gaur on a skerry, a sopping rock standing just clear of the water.
"It's much too far for you to swim," he said. "Much too far. So when the tide rises..."
Fjallar looked at Gaur, and both brothers grimaced.
"We've a suggestion," said Fjallar.
"Since it has come to this," said Gaur, "we're willing to offer you our greatest treasure."
Then Fjallar described the mead, both its origin and power, with a wealth of words.
"Give us our lives," said Gaur, "and we'll give it to you."
"Agreed," said Suttung.
So Suttung took the two dwarves back to their cave, and since they clearly had no choice, they handed over Kvasir's blood. The giant stumped back to Jotunheim, carrying Son in one hand and Bodin in the other, and Odrerir under his arm. He took the precious liquid to the mountain Hnitbjorg, where he lived. Suttung hewed a new chamber out of the rock in the heart of the mountain and hid the three crocs in it. And he told his daughter Gunnlod that she had one duty.
"Guard this mead by day and guard it by night."
Unlike the dwarf brothers, Suttung was boastful about his treasure.
So it was not long before the gods learned about the divine mead and heard how it had fallen into Suttung's unholy hands.
Odin himself elected to go to Jotunheim and bring the mead back to Asgard. The masked god, the one-eyed god, god of the gods, disguised himself as a giant of a man and called himself Bulverk, worker of evil. He crossed the river that divided Asgard and Jotunheim and strode across a desert of shifting gray grit where nothing, not even a grass blade, could take root. Bulverk came to a curtain of mountains. He hurried over a snowy pass and at last walked down into a narrow green valley. 9 thralls were working in the sloping field, men from Midgard with a taste for adventure and handsome reward. They were scything the succulent grass with long, slow sweeps and seemed very weary.
"Who is your master?" Bulverk asked one thrall who had stopped work entirely.
"Balgi," said one thrall.
"Balgi?"
"Suttung's brother," the thrall said, "the giant who guards Kvasir's blood."
"Shall I sharpen your scythe?" asked Bulverk affably.
The thrall was rather quick to agree to this, and when Bulverk drew a whetstone from his belt and began to put a new edge on the scythe, the other thralls crowded around in the hope that he would hone their scythes too. Bulverk obliged, and the thralls all said that their scythes had never been quite as sharp before. They complained that the giant Balgi was too hard a taskmaster. They pointed to an acre of grass still uncut that lay before them. Coming to the point, the thralls asked whether they could buy the hone.
"I might think about selling it," said Bulverk, "but only to one man and only to the one, if there is such a man here, who will feast me tonight in the manner to which I'm accustomed."
The air was filled with shouts of agreement.
"Yes," the thralls shouted. "Yes, me, I will. Here, all right. I'm your man. Done. Agreed. Your hand on it."
Bolvric looked at them with his one eye. He smiled grimly. Then he threw the whetstone into the air. In the sun it glinted, it looked like silver. The thralls gasped. They raised their sides and ran, all of them eager to be under the whetstone when it fell. It seemed to hang in the air, so high had Bolvric tossed it. The thralls jostled. They stepped backwards. They suddenly swung round, and in the end, in their confusion, they had all slit each other's throats. The nine of them lay in the long grass they had just cut. Still smiling grimly, Bolvric caught the whetstone, tucked it into his belt, and walked back the way he had come. The sun dawdled, and so did Allfather. Not until nearly midnight did he come down from the mountains again and make his way to Balgeist Farm. He said his name was Bolvric and explained that he had been walking all day. Then he asked Balgi if he could give him some kind of a meal and let him stay overnight in one of the huge barns near to the farmhouse. "A fine time to ask," said Balgi abruptly. Bolvric looked pained and asked Balgi what was wrong. "All my farmhands have been killed, that's what's wrong," Balgi said. Balgi banged his fist on a trestle table, a blow so powerful that it would have flattened a man's head. "All nine of them! And how can I hope to find any more at this time of year?"
"I've an idea," said Bolvric. "You can see I'm strong, very strong. I can take on the work of nine men."
Balgi looked Bolvric up and down and smiled in disbelief, thinking Bolvric was a hollow boaster.
"And if I agreed, what wages would you ask?"
"Only this," said Bolvric. "One drink of Sutung's mead."
Balgi sniffed and shook his head.
"I may be strong," said Bolvric, "but to be a poet, that's the finest calling."
"That mead has nothing to do with me," said Balgi. "My brother has it in his safe keeping, and no one except Gunnlod has ever seen a drop of it. That's how things are."
"Well," said Bolvric, "those are my terms."
Balgi shrugged his shoulders, and so Bolvric got up to leave.
"I can talk to Sutung," said Balgi.
He had little love for his brother, but he felt sure that in any case Bolvric would never be strong enough to keep his part of the bargain.
"Work for me this summer, and I'll tell my brother how you helped me out. That's the best I can do."
"How far can I trust you?" said Bolvric.
"You'll see," said Balgi.
For as long as the long days, Bolvric worked for Balgi. As the sun climbed out of the east, Bolvric walked to the green fields, still thick with the honeydew that fell every night from the branches of Yggdrasil. All day he worked under the bright skull of the sky. He worked while the sun hurried west until it seemed to hang, blood red, on the western skyline. Balgi was amazed that Bolvric was as good as his boast, and seemed to need so little rest, he thought now that Bolvric must be more than merely human. At the end of the summer, Bolvric asked Balgi for his wages. They went together to find Sutung at Hnitbjorg, and Balgi told his brother how Bolvric had helped him, and asked him for some of the divine mead.
"Never," said Sutung, "not a drop."
"Well," said Bolvric, as soon as he was alone with Balgi, "I hope you're not going to accept Sutung's answer. I've worked for you all summer."
"I've kept my promise," Balgi said.
"Why should he have it all for himself?" said Bolvric.
"Don't you fancy a mouthful, Balgi?
Since your brother won't part with the mead willingly, let us see if we can trick him out of it."
"Impossible," said Balgi. "Do you know where it is hidden?"
He was rather nervous of Sutung, but he was also rather nervous of Bolvric. Bolvric pulled an auger called Rati out of his belt and told the giant that with it he might be able to drill a hole into the mountain.
"This is the least you can do in return for my work."
Balgi took the auger and pressed the shank against the sheer rock face of the mountain Hnitbjorg, and with both hands he turned the handle. He wondered how to get rid of the troublesome farmhand as he wound and wound and the auger sank into the mountain.
"There," exclaimed the giant, "right through."
He withdrew the drill and wiped his brow. Bolvric peered with his one eye into the dark passage left by the auger. Then he filled his lungs and blew fiercely into it. A shower of rock chippings blew back into his face, and Bolvric knew that Balgi had not, after all, cored the mountain.
Were you trying to cheat me? He said. The giant said nothing. He drilled further into the mountain, vowing silently to dispose of Bulwark as soon as he could. When Baugi withdrew the auger once more, and Bulwark blew down the hole a second time, all the loose chippings were carried forward on the tide of air. Then Bulwark knew that the giant had bored right into the room at the heart of Nytbjorg. At once he turned himself into a snake and writhed into the auger hole. Baugi stabbed at Bulwark with the point of the auger, but he was not quick enough. The snake was already halfway down the passage on his way to Gudlod and the Divine Mead. As soon as he reached the stronghold, Bulwark changed himself back into a giant of a man, one-eyed but handsome, and stood in front of Suttung's daughter. Gudlod was sitting on a stool of solid gold, and at the sight of Bulwark, Suttung's stern warning that she should guard the mead flew right out of her head. She was sorry not to have company. She sat and listened to Bulwark's beguiling words and songs. She wrapped her arms around him. For 3 days they talked and laughed, and for 3 nights they slept together. In the silent cave under Nytbjorg, the heartless father of the gods made love to the spellbound daughter of Suttung. Then Gudlod was drunk with passion and ready to give Bulwark whatever he desired. He asked for 3 draughts of Kvasir's blood, and Gudlod took his hand and led him to the mead. With his first draught, Bulwark emptied Odrarir. With a second draught, Bodin. With his third draught, Son. The father of the gods held all of the divine mead in his mouth. Then Odin turned himself into an eagle, flapped down the passage out of Nytbjorg, and headed for Asgard. Suttung saw him, and at once murmured the magic words known only to those who have drunk divine mead. Gods and angels and men and dwarves saw a dark sight, one eagle pursuing another toward the kingdom of Asgard. The Aesir quickly brought out jars and bowls and laid them side by side so that they covered the entire courtyard just inside the great wall of Asgard. Anxiously they watched as Suttung came closer and closer to Odin. The distant rustle became a whir, and the whir a terrible flapping and beating of wings. There was only a wingspan between the two birds. Then the eagle Odin dived in over the wall and spat the mead into the crocs assembled beneath him. In his haste to escape Suttung, Odin could not help letting some mead spill outside the wall, but it was so little that the gods were not bothered about it. They said that anyone who wanted it could have it, and that became the poetaster's portion. Suttung shrieked and wheeled away and shrieked again. He had lost through cunning what he had won through force, and there was nothing he could do. And the gods? They had lost wise Kvasir, witness to the friendship between the Aesir and the Vanir. But because of the cunning of the Allfather, they had won back his blood. Once more, Odin drank some of the precious mead, and from time to time he offered a draught to one of the Aesir, or even a man or two in Midgard. He offered them the gift of poetry.
So I hope you've enjoyed the mead of poetry. As with most of these mythological readings, I find this to be an exceptionally interesting story. We certainly have a lot of similarities with other myths in other Indo-European cultures, which suggests to folklorists that perhaps this is a very early myth. The story out there with the most similarities to this one, of course, is the story of the god Indra. Now, this, of course, would be in Hindu mythology, but the god Indra took the shape of an eagle to steal the beverage called Soma, which was sort of the all-purpose beverage of the god, sort of like Energon for the Transformers. It can kind of do anything from grant immortality, etc., which is a little bit different, of course, from what we see here in this story. Like most myths, this is designed to explain something. In this case, why do poets exist? Why are there people who are better at expressing themselves through poetry and music than others? I can only imagine being a wandering skald back in the 8th or 9th century and telling the story and how much fun they must have had with this. Like a lot of this old folklore, this story really has something for everyone. Can you imagine a big group of people sitting around a fire? You're going to have people of all ages and all sizes and all genders, etc. And this really kind of has something for everyone. It has a little romance, it has some violence, poetry, and so I think that this is a really interesting story. As always, this adaptation of the story is from Kevin Crossley Holland's The Norse Myths, and the music is from Edain, The Invincible Sword of the Elvesmith, by Mats Wendt, and is used with permission. As always, if you have any thoughts on the program, please feel free to email the show, and the email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com, and you can also join us on Facebook and the Radio Free Asgard page over there. All right, so without further ado, let's move on with our review.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the God of Thunder, mighty Thor.
All right, so this week we'll be covering Thor Annual number 13. Has a cover date of December of 1985. This is the 1985 annual. Retailed for $1.25, which is 50p in the UK, and $1.50 in Canada. Now, what's really interesting about this annual is that this is really the only annual that Thor had during the time when Walt Simonson was on the book. Now, the previous annual, which was annual number 12, was published after Thor number 337. However, the story, the style, everything about it was more suited to the pre-Walt Simonson continuity. So, therefore, it really fits in better with those issues. And, of course, we'll be covering it in due time when we cover those episodes. It's interesting, though, that this is the last annual that we had until 1989 and the Atlantis Attacks crossover. Apparently, Walt Simonson not being a big fan of annuals, probably because he just didn't have time to do them. Anyway, the cover art shows Thor, and he's fighting the evil Ulik the Troll. You remember Ulik? Ulik, whose name is repeated over and over again throughout his first appearance. And the two of them are fighting in the hand of a large pink and red demonic-looking guy. And of course, longtime Marvel readers will recognize this gentleman as the evil Mephisto. Just one of the many demonic devil-type characters in the Marvel Universe. And he's this, for those of you who really aren't familiar with Mephisto, he's just one of these kind of generic personification of evil characters. And he had a particular hard-on for the Silver Surfer. But also Thor made several appearances with Mephisto in his own book. So anyway, we open up to the splash page where we have the credits. Alan Zelenitz, who was the scripter of Thor before Walt Simonson took over, was the scripter on this. Artist is by John Buscema. And John Buscema, of course, certainly no stranger to Thor, and indeed was the artist on many, many Thor issues before Walt Simonson took over. John Morelli was the letterer. George Russos was colorist. Ralph Macchio was the editor. And Jim Shooter was the editor-in-chief. And we open up with the title of the story, "And Evil Shall Inherit." And we see a silhouette of Mephisto, and he's holding what appears to be a dead woman or naked woman or something like that. Anyway, she's a woman and she's got boobs and she's limp. And it's just, you just see them in like a shadow cast against a stone cliff. And Mephisto is like, "Another infant soul snatched from the clasp of unsuspecting innocence. Aye, sheer spite is the sweetest nectar in Mephisto's realm." And we see what looks like octopus tentacles coming out from behind a rock and strangling this green little, I don't know what that is. It's a demon of some kind. Anyway, next page we see Mephisto, of course, and he's throwing this, what apparently is a soul, into a flaming pit. And he's surrounded by this sort of branches of rock and sort of lava and fire and very hell-looking dimension that he lives in. And he's saying that his thirst for evil is not yet slaked, for though there be pleasure in the torture of lost souls, still he's not satisfied. I, who ruled the Stygian depths eons before time squalled from the womb of eternity. And he goes walking over this bridge, and the bridge is made of people. At least made of souls, if not literal physical bodies. And he's walking over them, and they're crying out to Mephisto, "Mercy, most satanic majesty! Tread not upon the bridge of woes! You dare address your lord unbid?
You slaves dare whimper in our regal presence, ingrates. Feel the full weight of agony. And he grows really big, and he's stomping on this bridge, and all the faces of all the people that are made up, making up the bridge, are all like screaming and pain and all that stuff. And he walks over the bridge, and he's still not really satisfied. He's like, bah, confound this cursed tedium. I swear, eternity's too long. It circles infinitely round and round in emptiness. I need more profound satisfaction than gathering the weak-willed mortal souls. Not since I opposed the Silver Surfer have I challenged true goodness. See, I told you he has a hard-on for the Silver Surfer. Though hosts of demons have worn my guise on occasion to accomplish petty mischief. Okay, so he seems to be implying here that not all of his appearances have been him. But now Mephisto would see the cursed heaven's shame. The heaven's eye. Mayhap there is some promise of spiteful sort in the godly realms. For only recently did I sense a void in celestial Asgard. Bring the vapors of vision, beckons to these little pink, little goblin-looking gnome guys. And they're carrying a, what looks like a stone cauldron in the sort of yoke. And each one has part of it over their shoulders. And he's like, as our Lord Mephisto commands. What do the mystic vapors show? And he conjures up an image from this cauldron, and there's this pink mist coming up, and he sees the battle between Surtur and Odin, and Surtur looks absolutely nothing like he did in the comic. And he said, indeed, of late, Surtur, the fire demon, raised war against Asgard. But King Odin saved his realm by self-sacrifice, hurtling headlong with Surtur into a fiery crevice of no return. Yet not before the demon and his hordes had ravaged the heavenly city. But where is Thor the Thunderer? Why does not he rule in his father's stead? And he scries in on Thor. And this was during that time, right after Odin fell down the hole. Remember when Thor was kind of wandering around the countryside on his horse, feeling sorry for himself? This is where that takes place. And he sees Thor wandering on his horse around a frozen countryside. He's like, so, Odin's son mourns his father's passing and seeks solitude and peace of mind in the wilderness. His countenance paints the very portrait of despondency and of despair that will plot your defeat, godling. For a downcast warrior is easiest to defeat. I shall torture the Prince of Asgard's spirit. What greater pleasure than to see one so divine and noble suffer to his soul? So ordains Mephisto. The Thunderer's spirit nears breaking, but I need to send a foe to batter his frame. Then Thor's soul will be ravaged, and Asgard remain in chaos and desolation. Begone, my servant of flame, and summon to my bidding Thor's mightiest foe. And there's this fire being that he sends off, and there's a couple other demon guys kind of working around. One of them looks like a melty wax guy, and the other one kind of looks like a wingless gargoyle. And again, we have these rock pillars and what looks like trees made out of rock. And that's sort of, with the fire, kind of the only decoration in this place. And he sends the fire off to the Troll Realm. And we turn to the Troll Realm. We have a beautiful double-page splash here of the Troll Realm. And there's, yeah, they're hammering and making their evil weapons and just kind of doing whatever trolls do and casting metal and making whatever it is the trolls make. And Ulic is there. And he has this big bullwhip with spikes on it, and whoopsh, whoopsh.
Flaster sluggards, hammer pound. Burn the forges, bend your backs. I demand 1,000 weapons more for my deadly arsenal.
We cut to another troll. This one's much smaller than Ulic and is bald, and he's kind of wimp. I guess a troll wimp, and he's like, you there, Ironsmith, do you not hear my mighty brother Ulic? To the task! And they're like, hold your cursed prod, Horth. We are armorers, not slaves. And they strike him, and he's like, oh, Ulic, I'm struck.
Who dares assault my flesh and blood? My brother.
And Ulic smashes this troll with a giant batoom. So Ulic doesn't like people picking on his brother, obviously.
Since the day wine-sodden giants slew our sire and dam, Horth has been in my charge. Woe the troll who dares offend him.
Well, it's kind of odd that we've never seen Horth before now, and of course we'll never see him again.
Now back to your labors, you gaping halfwits.
And as they are going off, hear a voice going, Ulic,
who intrudes below?
His Majesty Mephisto, Dark Lord of all that is evil, commands that you hasten surfaceward at once. Your task...
My task? Never! No one commands Ulic, the most powerful of all trolls. I scoff at your lord's errands. And he picks up these giant calipers, and he grabs the fire demon that Mephisto sent to him and seized him in like these caliper tong things and throws him into the forge. And he's like, so heat my furnaces, devil. And all the trolls are laughing. And Ahorth is like, ha, brother, how the demon squirmed. And then all of a sudden there's a giant barroom and the forge explodes. And the form of Mephisto appears in the fire. He says, impudent fool, none may defy Mephisto. And Ulic picks up his whip with the extremely classic dialogue here. Grar, I am enraged. And he is he's defying Mephisto and says, by hell's dragon, I'll not do your bidding ever. And all of a sudden his whip with the spikes on it changes into ash and just drops into pieces. And he's like, my lash dissolved. And the Mephisto shoots like some sort of a beam at him out of his hand. And we see that Ulic is encased in this sort of rock harness thing. It's designed to keep him captive. And Ulic's like, what have you done? Let me free. And Mephisto is much larger than Ulic and is kind of haunching over him and saying, utter one more word, troll, and I shall turn you into a mouthless stone forever. And Ulic is still defying him. It's like, turn me to stone, I'll not be your slave. Bold braggart, I'll bend your will. Thrash his godly form and trounce the thunderer until his very soul cries out, enough, Mephisto, I am yours. For your arrogance, your brother comes with me. And he grabs Horth and picks him up. So Horth is basically is a plot device, and that's it. To assure the deed I command be done, above these caverns in Asgard's wilderness, Thor, Prince of Asgard, rides alone. Now, Ulic, unless you vanquish Thor... And he kind of pops away, and Ulic's like, Horth, no! Mephisto vanishes, and Ulic's like, curse you, Mephisto! I'll not let my brother die. Grar! Bring me the armored craft and metal pounders. And there's this really corny-looking, like, digging machine here, and it's like an underground car that has this giant auger on the front. So kind of like the auger in the myth that we just read, and you know, which can apparently drill through rock. Now, even though this thing looks like it's kind of made out of rock itself, so you kind of wonder how effective that might be, especially if it's going to move at any speed at all. And it has these really knobbly tires that look like they're made of rock as well. And Ulic hops into this vehicle. Now, what's interesting is this vehicle doesn't have any kind of a windshield or anything, though. There's kind of a cage over it. So I guess all the rock chippings and stuff just come right into the cockpit, because that's what would happen. Ulic's ultra drill shatters earth before it and grinds the tuffic rock to nothing, as he felt obliged to say that out loud.
Because exposition. And one other thing that I want to point out about this is that this really doesn't look like a drill. It looks like a screw. So this, I guess it's the screw-mobile or something.
I hie me to the surface world of hated daylight. That Horth may live, the Thunder God must die. And he drives his screw car into the wall, and the other trolls are like, never have I seen such naked rage. Ulic can't be stopped, Thor is doomed. His blazing wrath bids fair to shake the very spheres. And we then cut to above, where Thor is riding his horse through a desolate landscape, where he has mountains and snow and trees and stuff. And Thor's talking to his horse. No doubt you weary of your sorrowful burden, my noble steed. For in my relentlessness I drive you ever onward, seeking solace that is more elusive than a summer frost. I fear I do not wear an orphan's mantle well, but the loss of my father is like a dark dragon that devours the fondest moments of my past as though they had never been. Yeah, yeah, Thor's a drama queen, we knew that. Hark, I hear sounds from these barren woods. Who goes there? Show thyself, or... And this old man staggers out from behind a tree. He's like, spare us, warrior. We are but poor. By the world tree, it's Prince Thor. And he gets off his horse. And he says, and you, an honest fellow of Asgard, by your dress and mane.
Aye, my lord.
Astrid, children, come see who greets us in this forsaken spot. Good my lord, we are refugees of the late mayhem twixt Odin and Surtur that shook the kingdom's capital and ravaged our home. We seek the safe shelter of kindred blood cousins beyond these hills. Grace us with your presence to our journey's end, my liege. Break loaf with us and share our mead.
Much thanks, my friends, but I must decline. I too seek refuge from Asgard ruins, but solitude is the best companion for my present grief. And he's going to tell them Odin preserve you, but he realizes that you can't really do that, because Odin's gone. And he's like, the Norns of fate protect thee, friends.
And give balm to your sorrow, noble prince.
And Thor goes riding off, and he's thinking about how horrible he feels, because Thor's a big old drama queen. And then Ulrich's giant screw car comes bursting out of the ground with a Brax. Pretty good pick. There's a lot of really large panels in the story and full-page spreads and stuff, so it's kind of hard to describe while I'm reading it like this. And Thor's like, Ymir's blood! And Ulrich hops out of his screw car, and he's like, prepare to die, Thunder God! I am come to kill you! And Thor's like, Ulrich, my metal pounders shatter whole mountains. They will crush the life from you, Asgardian.
You would suffer so again, were I of mind to answer your boasts. But I mourn my father's loss, and have no heart for battle. Stand aside and let me pass.
Spoken like a true coward, stripling of Asgard. But then what are gods but empty words and soft bellies? I stand firm to bar your way.
Nay, villain, if I must, have at thee! To the death!
And the two of them square off against each other, and we cut to Mephisto in his throne room, and he's laughing as all goes as Mephisto wills.
The mindless Ulrich is a living bludgeon. An Asgard prince fights joylessly. He must succumb.
And there's a big snake there and wraps itself around Mephisto, though it's not at all important to the story.
To see a god despair. The very thought fulfills my most demonic desires.
So they're fighting Thor and Ulrich. We cut back to them, and Thor's thinking that he has the strength of 1,000 trolls. And Ulrich's boasting and says, ha! You are far more easily destroyed than even I thought, godling. And Thor's like, destroyed? Nay, I merely add your weight to my own. Thus, and he does like a judo throw and throws Ulrich into the ground. And he's like, grar, you better rouse my rage. And he picks up a tree. Yes, we have tree death here in this issue, folks. And a crunk, and he rips this tree out of the ground. It's like a sequoia. It's an absolutely enormous tree.
Ulrich is the greatest of trolls!
And he throws this giant tree at Thor with a thoom, and Thor takes his hammer and smashes it to splinters. Ulrich is like,
cry no mercy, Thunder God, your end draws nigh!
And he tackles Thor manually and with his pounders, and he's pounding on him with his pounders, and Thor drops his hammer. Thor manages to regain his hammer and smacks Ulrich, and Ulrich goes flying into a cliffside. And then Ulrich gets up, and he's all mad, and he takes his pounders and starts hammering on the ground. And, of course, you know, that can't bode well here in this wintry landscape, and all this rock and snow, and basically it's this giant, enormous avalanche coming down on Thor. And Thor realizes that the only way that he's going to be able to escape this is by whirling his hammer really, really fast. I must wheel Mjolnir with more fury than I have ever done. And pray its whirlwind fling the snowslide into space. But have I the strength left to do the deed? And you see him whirling around like an Ajax white tornado, and all the rocks and snow go flying. And so apparently he manages to do it. But Ulrich is still coming at him, and Thor's like, my muscles ache. I can go on no longer. Enough, Ulrich. I weary of your game.
You cower, for you are close to death. Like your cursed father, Odin. Hela take his soul.
And that pisses Thor off. And he's like, befoul not my sire's memory with your rank breath, hateful troll. Your cursed insults have renewed life to my flagging limbs. And he's beating on Ulrich and smacking him down and hammering him into cliff sides. And he actually gets some like Batman sound effects here. We've got thwam, thack, pacow. And he basically beats Ulrich down, but Ulrich is still conscious, and he's like, come to your feet, troll. I have fury yet to feed, and would topple you again with these naked fists. And Ulrich is like,
Nay, Thunderer, I am ashamed in my defeat. You have doomed Horth to die. And he's like, who the hell's Horth? And Thor's like, Mephisto urged this battle on me to batter your soul. He stole my brother Horth and vowed he would die if you were not broken in spirit. But to battle merely as the pawn of another is not the way of Ulic. Then cursed Mephisto has failed. Thor's soul is no devil's booty. Bam chicka bam bam. Now I am gone to brood upon my father's death in solitude. Go, Thunder God. I'll not beg you to save my brother's life, for what is he to you? And Thor's like, I'm no savior of trolls. But he got to thinking about it, and he's thinking, what is Ulic's brother to me? I am vexed in spirit and seek no further combat this day. Yet, can I turn my back on any being who seeks divine aid? Is this what the mighty Thor has come to in his time of sorrow? And he looks back at Ulic and he says, the way of Asgard has always been the way of life, and even a troll's life is precious beyond understanding. I will redeem your brother and warn Mephisto of his arrogance in daring to betray the Prince of Asgard. Begone now. Leave Heaven's realm to be at peace and homewards hie to your caverns. So be it. Hear me, Mephisto. I shall scour the universe and track you to your Stygian sphere if it take all And he's interrupted by this huge golden explosion. And we have a full-page spread here of Thor standing before Mephisto in Mephisto's realm. And Mephisto is sitting on the... It's either like a big sculpture of like this giant creature with a big gaping mouth, or he's actually sitting in some kind of creature's mouth. I guess it could be either one because of this hell dimension that he's in. Thor is like, it's Mephisto. And Mephisto's like, and when you find me, what then, godling? I know not how you brought me here, devil, but I seek the life of Horth, the troll. And Mephisto's like, you think life means aught to me? The troll was cast into death's pit before his brother ever challenged you. I never intended to free him, even had you lost to Ulic, as you most assuredly shall to Mephisto. And Thor gets all mad, he hurls his hammer, and Mephisto manages to catch the hammer, and it melts into this, like, puddle of goo, and he's like, do you call this slag enchanted, Thunder God? But he uses his magic to restore the hammer. It's like, do you pretend or are you merely ignorant of the fact that Mephisto rises above enchantment? Your hammer, like all else, is infinitely vain in the face of eternal evil. But you insult me to think that I shall engage you in a battle of brute force. Bah! I leave such doings to mindless fools like Ulic. My intent is to drain your willful spirit till naught be left but a naked, quivering, and despairing soul, which I shall clasp to my bosom as the greatest prize of all. Oh, my. No, Mephisto, you shall never break my will, for I fight until the last breath. We shall see. Thus, and Mephisto waves his hand, and he summons up what looks like Odin. And Odin's standing there in his pale blue armor and kind of pointy hat. And it's really weird how weird this looks after reading a couple years worth of Simonson issues, because this is very much pre-Simonson sort of Odin costuming here. You have your sort of medieval high-tech Viking thing going on here, and Simonson really has a more rustic sort of costuming for all of the Asgardians, so it's really quite a shock. And the shade of Odin, or image, or illusion, or whatever it is, says, hearken ye to Lord Mephisto, my son, and join me in his eternal realm. I beg you heed your father's spirit. No, it cannot be. My father fell in noble battle, and merits Valhalla Hall as final reward. His soul could not be here. Are you so certain this is not your father's shade? That you would let a conjured harpy rend him limb from limb? And Mephisto does this dramatic gesture over his shoulder and summons this orange furry harpy. So the harpy is like a female body with eagle wings and talons and that sort of thing. It grabs the fake Odin by the wrist. I'm just assuming it's a fake Odin. And Thor's like, enough, vulture. I've seen my father die already once. He reaches for the harpy, and the harpy grabs Thor and carries him up, 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 way high up. Thor's thinking, this monster grips me in my father's stead. So the harpy's holding Thor, and it smashes him against the sort of rock pillar thing that's kind of at random here in this kingdom. And he's lost his hammer. He somehow manages to drop the hammer,
And of course, you know, without the hammer, he can't fly. And he starts to fall, and there's this huge, like, ocean of pink fire below him, and that's where he's falling to. And so he manages somehow to grab onto one of these stone archway things that we've seen in other panels here. There's a lot of these, like, archways and pathways kind of made of stone floating through. Yeah, it's very convenient that he found one anyway. So he grabs onto it, and it stops him from falling, and he's like, "Praise the Norns!" But now the horror swoops down to complete its deadly task. I am so exhausted. How easy it would be for me to yield to Mephisto. But no, I cannot. And then Thor swings around and he kicks the harpy right in the face. And the harpy goes falling into the pink lake of fire and goes, "Aye!" And Thor then summons his hammer to him. Now if my father's soul does truly be... And as he says that, the illusion of his father is fading away, and Mephisto reveals that, "Ha, your father's soul? Not but an illusion of smoke. I sense despair tightening around your heart to see your father's vision fade. But Mephisto has yet more to show you. Fetch the ebony crystal, slave." And he summons this demon thing with... looks like he's, like, made of goop. John Buscema in this issue has a real knack for drawing these kind of melty, goopy-looking creatures. Has two big stumpy legs and a tail, but doesn't have a face or anything. It's just kind of like this molten, globby thing. And it has one arm, and it's carrying this ebon crystal in his hand. And there's another kind of bat thing kind of lurking around in the rocks below. And you see, like, this other demon kind of crawling up out of a crack. And the demon says, "No sooner bid than done, master." And Mephisto takes the crystal, and he says, "For certain you recall the blooming rose the goddess Sif gave you as a token of her love, Asgardian. Yes, how fondly you compared the flower's hue to the blush upon her cheek on that summer morn." And we see kind of see that scene being played out here. "See where that rose rests now, black and blighted in my realm." And this big tendril with all these big spikes on it grows up from the ground. "Symbol of the death of love." And a spiny thing grabs Thor and's wrapping around him, and Thor's like, "Its spiny tendrils pierce my flesh like spears of troll iron, and its grip is 10 times that of Ulix, crushing the breath of life from my lungs. No! Life's forced must assert itself." And he manages to smash his way out of it somehow. Really can't tell because it looks like he's pretty well pinned by this thing, but somehow he manages it. And he's like, "I am free, Mephisto. For life renews itself, though heartfelt loss and dashed hopes have ever seemed to crush it." "Is that your preaching, godling? Yet for a single moment of life there are many evils. To battle them all is to empty the oceans with a sieve, a vain illusion. Behold in the vapors of vision the scene just passed as you did battle with Ulic. Though you defeated Ulic, still his deadly avalanche struck the family of Asgardians who passed that way. They died all beneath Ulic's crashing snow and stone." And see that, yep, indeed, they all got smooshed. "So though you did indeed vanquish Ulic, in the larger scheme your loyal subjects met a most pitiful end."
"This is but one more deceit to crack my heart with despair. Liar, they are not dead."
"Ha, you do discover my tricks too easily, godling."
"Fie on you, wretch, enough. I summon the wrath of the skies above and the driving storm against you and your fiery abode." And Thor uses his hammer to cause it to start storming here in Mephisto's fire land. And there's rain coming down and everything's getting wet. "Thor's heart's passion shall be manifest in heaven's flooding torrents." And Mephisto just laughs at this. It's like,
"No, how like a god. Such arrogance. You think to distinguish evil's flame that burned bright before your petty realm of Asgard was a speck in the eye of infinity. Will you stand here, mallet upraised for all eternity, the very portrait of futility?"
And Thor's thinking, he speaks the truth. Rashness and frustration will not defeat such primal evil incarnate. It stops the rain, I guess. He says, "Mayhap I cannot stay your evil, Mephisto, but I shall never yield my will nor cease to fight."
"Bah, I have had my moment's pleasure. But you have learned that Mephisto's evil is not done for goals and gain. Nay, mine is the truest evil, done for no end but itself, acted without thought of consequence and without measure, so long as there is light, so there will be shadow. Begone! I dismiss you, and know that Mephisto is always behind you, undefeatable, dogging your every step.
And Mephisto waves his hand and sends Thor back to Asgard, and he's calling for the vapors of vision again. And this time it's only being brought by one creature, and it's not in a yoke. It's this kind of one creature carrying it himself.
The vapors of vision, for I would see the Thunderer's face when he discovers the wanderers of Asgard truly dead beneath the avalanche.
And we see him using his vapors to spy on Thor, and he's discovering the dead bodies of the people who he talked to earlier. He's like, indeed, the devil spoke true. Now I know my father's memory shall not be served by meditation, but by steadfast purpose indeed. These deaths have only strengthened my resolve. Upon this very spot I'll raise a stone memorial to these innocents, whose deaths shall not be in vain. Even the brother of Ulic shall not be forgotten. No, Mephisto, I shall only double my vigilance against you. And it looks like Thor's laughing. I don't think it's meant to be Thor, but it wouldn't make any sense that Thor would be laughing at this. But you see Thor and hear, ha 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 ha, I guess that's Mephisto laughing. And on the final page of the story, we see Mephisto, and he's sitting on his throne, and there's like this stone octopus thing, and he's got this really elaborate sort of drinking glass with steam coming up off it, and Mephisto saying,
erect your hollow monuments, Thunder God. Unlike my evil, in time they will crumble to dust. Aye, sheer spite is the sweetest nectar in Mephisto's realm.
And that's Thor Annual number 13 from 1985. So, few things about it. Very different in style and tone than anything we're seeing in the Simonson run. Now, obviously, the reason for that is because it has a different creative team. Alan Zelenitz, of course, the writer, was the writer on Thor, at least for a few issues, before Walt Simonson took over the book. So not an era of Thor that I'm particularly fond of. However, it's a solid enough story, though they could have told this in the normal 24-page issue rather than stretch it out to 39 pages. Now, the person who was really responsible for stretching this out into 39 pages would have had to have been John Buscema, the artist. Not to be confused with Sal Buscema, whose artwork I've made fun of before on this series. John Buscema, of course, a longtime veteran of the Thor book, has drawn the character probably thousands and thousands of times, and is a very well thought of artist in terms of Marvel Silver Age, and even into the modern era. Don't think that he's alive anymore, but we'll talk more about John Buscema when the Lee Kirby era is over, and we actually have John Buscema drawing issues of the book. Now, the art in the issue is actually somewhat different than I'm used to seeing from John Buscema. John Buscema has typically a very detailed, very almost Kirby-esque style. Of course, he was one of those people who took on the task of replacing Kirby when Kirby left Marvel in 1973. So you really have a drastic change here between what we're used to seeing, and it is rather jarring to think that this is still in the same continuity as Walt Simonson's Thor. Now, I do believe here that John Buscema is inking his own work, and that gives it an entirely different quality. I don't think I've seen Buscema ink his own work before, and I kind of like it. I think that he has a lot of talent, a lot of real knack for layout in a way that his brother doesn't. And I really enjoyed the artwork on this issue. Not all of it is brilliant, but hey, you know, it never is. And of course, he's also dealing with the fact that he is a classic Marvel artist, in the era where art is tending to be rather sketchy. We're not quite in the extreme 90s yet, but this is kind of the run-up to that, and art has started to get kind of sketchier and more distorted, and this is kind of a return to classic form. So I do like the art. Anyway, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to go up and wrap the show up now. Thanks very, very much for listening, as always. And, of course, you can contact the show if you want to at radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. All right, this is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next time here on Radio Free Asgard.